You're listening to episode 341. Have you ever wondered if your inability to stay consistent with a new habit is about psychology and mindset, or is it just about the physical body? Is your brain and nervous system structurally broken, and can you fix it? This is a fantastic conversation about the line that is straddled by psychologists and neuroscientists about overcoming adversity and maintaining healthy habits. Habits that will absolutely transform everything about yourself, as long as you can actually maintain them. And in here, we talk about just how you can do that. Along with it, we also cover a new habit that you can introduce that helps manage, prevent, and reverses up to 26 illnesses and diseases. So if you want to avoid death by comfort and finally commit to changing without letting go, then let's dive in.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? Here we are on today's episode of the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. As you may or may not know, and if you don't know, you're about to, that in 2024, it's my mission to coach 500 people to get control of their sugar cravings and sugar binges so they can stop yo-yo dieting, stop obsessing about food, and finally create a body that they feel confident being in. And to be confident, you've kind of got to back yourself. And to back yourself, sometimes you have to have the courage to do hard things. It's pretty hard to believe in yourself with absolutely no evidence of your own capabilities. Someone that is right up there in the list of people that are really good at doing hard things and helping you to figure out yourself and how to do hard things for yourself is the man himself, Mr. Paul Taylor. Paul is a former British Royal Navy aircrew officer and former adjunct professor at the University of San Francisco. He's a neuroscientist, exercise physiologist, and nutritionist who is currently completing a PhD in applied psychology, in which he is developing and testing resilience strategies with the Australian Defence Science and Technology Group, as well as the University of Newcastle. He was voted the Australian Fitness Industry Presenter of the Year twice, and in 2022, he published the book Death by Comfort, which won the Australian Business Book Award in 2023 in the health and well-being category. What a legend. Paul, mate, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marty. That actually makes me sound reasonably impressive, doesn't it?
It does. You're kind of nailing life.
Well, the devil makes work for idle hands like mine, so I need to keep myself out of mischief.
I'm curious, getting out of that mischief, how did you go from being a military man to over here in Australia working on a PhD in applied psychology? What's that journey look like?
Yeah, well, look, it was an interesting one. I had, before I joined, I was quite a late joiner. I had already done a degree and I'd done a master's in exercise science. And then I went traveling for a while. Then I joined the military. And when I was doing helicopter search and rescue in Scotland, there was a lot of free time. A lot of guys were playing video games and stuff like that. And I thought, I need to do something a bit more useful. So I did another master's degree part-time at the University of Glasgow. And so that set me up because I knew that that was kind of my next career, was adding to my exercise background with a nutritional background. And so I left the military because I'd met a young lady in Ecuador who was an Aussie who dragged me here kicking and screaming. not really, to be honest. But and then I met a mate of ours called Harper, Craig Harper.
Yeah.
And set up as an exercise physiologist and nutritionist in his place. And then after a while working with clients, I realized that it's not about knowledge. It's about helping people to change their behavior. So I went and did another postgrad in neuroscience. Mm-hmm. And then for me, the last piece of the jigsaw is psychology. So that's kind of how it's all just sort of morphed. It was really just that quest for more knowledge. And after a while, realizing, you know, when you're an exercise scientist, everything is about exercise. Mm-hmm. And then I studied nutrition. I'm like, ooh, actually, there's a lot extra going on here. And then you study neuroscience and you go, fucking hell, it's a lot about behavior change. And then if you're really going to get into behavior change and help people with the inevitable stresses of life, psychology was the obvious thing. And particularly, I've got a sort of a passion around stress and resilience. So that's kind of where I've ended up. But it's all in a quest, kind of like you, to help people become better versions of themselves.
Yeah, it's interesting. I find everything that I get into or go through a time where I'm like reading the research and I'm really into it, whether it's the physical movement or whether it's breath work or cold therapy or nutrition, I'm like, this is the thing. And then I move along and I'm like, oh, it's all of those things plus this thing.
That's right. And that will often, that new thing will often open doors to other new things as well, right? And so the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. That's the thing.
Yeah, the inevitable collection of knowledge means the inevitable awareness of all the knowledge you don't have.
Exactly.
So this is an interesting time to talk about resilience. And what I mean by that is that two schools of thought going on in my head. So knowing that we had this catch up today, I turned on the TV last night and it was sort of the trail end of A Current Affair was on, and it was the last couple of minutes. And they were talking about the fact that they needed to raise money for the construction industry in Australia because they're losing a construction worker to suicide every 2 days in Australia.
Wow.
Which is obviously awful. And then the other end of the spectrum, which is maybe a part of the same conversation, and I'm hoping we can just kind of unwrap it all, sort of trying to give us some points of reference for what we're about to talk about, is that we're in this sort of chapter of history where everybody seems to be rewarded just for showing up. And even if they come last, they get a medal. And, you know, everyone's great at everything all of the time. And so we've got this spectrum of this idea that telling kids they're amazing at everything has this idea that that will equal happiness or fulfillment or something. And then on the other end, we're producing a world where the suicide rate, particularly for young men, is, you know, 1 in 2 in the construction industry in Australia. What have we done wrong here?
Yeah, look, I think there's a number of things that we've actually done wrong here. And you've hit on a couple of my pet peeves. One of them, there have been well-intentioned psychologists who have over the years, with good intention, brought in a number of different approaches that are actually not serving us well. And you talked about the first one. It happened in the 1980s in the United States, where they did some research and saw that most people in prisons had low self-esteem, and that when people had higher self-esteem, they were less likely to offend. So they thought, 1 + 1 = 3. All we need to do is boost people's self-esteem, and then they're going to be better citizens. So they started this whole boosterism movement that came out of the United States, where it was all about telling little Johnny that they're awesome and they can be anything they want to be. And it just went around the world, this whole boosterism idea. And it turns out that it's not a good strategy, because they then grow up thinking that they're awesome and thinking that they can do anything.
Slightly delusional.
Yeah, they don't realize that there's a bell curve. On everything, there's a bell curve. Not everybody can be a friggin' astronaut, right? Or an astrophysicist or a doctor or whatever it may be. There is this bell curve. And then what happens when you're constantly falsely boosted? When that then interacts with reality, particularly post-school, people completely crash. And then that is coupled with what we're now seeing these days is lots of stress and mood disorders, particularly in children and teenagers. And then when they get into university, big problems around mood and self-esteem and dropouts and all of that. So then this other movement started around putting trigger warnings on everything. And you know, there's a trigger warning on this lecture and that lecture, and you don't have to read this book and you don't have to do that. And you have the right not to be offended. And what the research is now showing is that trigger warnings make people's mental health worse, even if they have PTSD, because it drives avoidance behavior. And we know that that is the worst thing for resilience. So we have brought up successive generations of children that have been mollycoddled, that have been falsely boosted, that have been given a false sense of how they're going to get on in the world. And then they go and they interact with the real world and the whole house of cards comes falling down. And at the same time, you mentioned construction workers. I think a huge part of it is also to do with their diet. Because I don't know how many times you've been in a service station getting petrol and tradies come in first thing in the morning and they walk out with a pie and a sausage roll and a couple of cans of V.
Yeah.
Or Monster or something like that. And what we now know is that diet, eating that diet that is really high in ultra processed foods, actually destroys people's mental health. There was a big umbrella review that you probably saw just released in the British Medical Journal that showed that a 10% increase in ultra processed foods equals a more than 40% increase in anxiety disorders and around a 50% increase in all mental disorders.
Yeah, well.
And it is just crazy. So when you start to combine those things together, and you have that backdrop where they're brought up lacking resilience and lacking the skills to deal with difficulties, then we're in real trouble. And then what happens as well is that they go to the doctor and they get prescribed an antidepressant. And we now know that what the pharmaceutical industry told us about their effectiveness and their safety is complete horseshit.
Yeah.
We know that antidepressants are marginally better than placebo, and they are a lot less effective than any type of exercise. They're a lot less effective than psychotherapy. And it turns out they have a ridiculous amount of side effects, including suicidation. About 50% of people who've been on an antidepressant have suicidal thoughts, and particularly when they try to get off the antidepressant, their mental health completely spirals. So there's a complex confluence of factors, and including social media and all of those things, and then disturbed sleep patterns as well. You know, we just talked about the, you know, a treaty with a couple of cans of V. We know that even one can a week has a significant impact on your sleep.
Yeah.
And you start to disturb sleep, you completely destroy mental health. And when you have bad sleep, it turns out that your food intake the next day is worse, and that you're less likely to exercise as well. Then you're less likely to deal with the stresses of the day's events. Then you're more likely to medicate yourself with either shit food or alcohol, which both impact your sleep that night. And then it's Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
So there are a number of things that are kind of coming together in modern society that are driving these outcomes. And it's not just young men, as teenage girls now are at a massive increased risk of suicide compared to 10 years ago.
Before I jump into the conversation about teenage girls and suicide, the other thing that popped up as you were talking about the sort of confounding factors, you know, the sleep and then the exercise. And if we talk about construction workers specifically, but this can probably be extrapolated to everyone, is that now, especially if you work for a big company in a city in the construction field, OH&S is such a major factor that the actual physical labor that a construction worker in 2024 would have done compared to 20 or 30 years ago, now we've got all these machines and cranes and different things that do the lifting. And actually, it used to be if you were a laborer or a construction worker, you just naturally looked jacked. You were ripped because you were lifting concrete all day. And nowadays, the average construction worker is quite visibly overweight. And so, you know, and that could be extrapolated to all of the technology that's been introduced to the home and to workplaces, where we're now not doing this incidental movement that once upon a time was just built into the way we lived.
Yeah, we have significant drops in both workplace physical activity and incidental physical activity, right? Our dedicated physical activity actually hasn't changed that much on average, but it's the massive drops in incidental. So that's how much you're moving when you're not at work or not doing sport or in the gym. That has fallen through the floor because we're just spending time on screens.
Yeah.
And there is a massive drop across the board in workplace physical activity. And when your physical activity drops, everything in your body suffers. I mean, everything in your body suffers. Because we know that physical exercise is absolutely critical to the success of the current human genome, which has not changed in over 45,000 years. We still have a hunter-gatherer's genome that is requires and expects us to be highly physically active for normal functioning. And we are, with our modern environments, we are depriving our genome of what it actually needs.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess the other thing that comes up as well is that, the difficulty of fitting things into a schedule with a consistently or a progressively more technologically driven world. And so now we're starting to see, you know, those walking desks. And so people are literally moving all day whilst they're sitting on those screens.
Those sorts of things are great when people actually have them and when people actually use them.
Yeah.
That's the key thing, because a lot of people will have sit-to-stand workstations and they use them for a little bit and then they just don't use them.
Novelty wears off.
Yeah, that's right. The novelty wears off. And we know that one of the biggest things around sitting is actually interrupting the sitting. It's when you're sitting for 20, 30 minutes or more a day that it creates a lot of damage molecularly. Mm-hmm. And then if you are sitting 10, 11 hours a day, you dramatically increase your risk of pretty much every chronic disease, mm-hmm. including dementia, which we're now starting to see playing out. And a lot of people go 10, 11 hours a day. That's a lot of sitting. If you think of the average office worker who is in there for 8 hours, they're sitting for 6.5 at least, right?
Yeah.
And then they're generally sitting on their commute. They're sitting at lunchtime. Then they come home. They're sitting to commute to come home. And then they're sitting for dinner. And then they've had a hard day. So they relax in front of a bloody screen, sitting on their arse. Mm-hmm. So when I do workshops and I get people to actually calculate how much they're sitting, it blows people away.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not surprised at all. I noticed myself. So I left working as a scientist about three and a bit years ago now. And I was in the lab a lot. I was in the ward a lot, up and down the hospital all of the time. And then I moved to this online podcast business reality. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm a sedentary person now. Like And that's one of the reasons like I wear my Garmin watch is because it buzzes. And says, get up and go for a walk.
Get off your arse.
Oh, yeah. Because, you know, when you get into that flow state of productivity as well, it's like you can just lock in for hours, you know, and be not having moved for 6 hours at a time.
Yeah, look, I say this to people and some people are surprised. Like if you have a job where you're on your feet for a significant amount of time, that has got to be worth tens of thousands of dollars per year in terms of the impact on your health and longevity. So be careful what you choose.
Oh, absolutely. It's so hard to, I guess, to, you know, do that long-term investment when we're in a world that is just so hyper addictive to the instant gratification, you know, the screens, the shows, the social media design, the sugar, you know, going to the service station to get petrol and seeing, you know, being hit with 100,000 marketing messages that are perfectly designed to say, just this once.
It's right there in front of you. Look at modern life. I mean, you've hit that nail on the head, Maddie. Modern life is set up to hijack our reward systems and to lure us into short-term gratification. And what we now know as well, so this is how the interactions get quite complex, right? So if you're not moving a lot, we know that people who are sedentary, they have less volume in their frontal lobes, and particularly the areas of the frontal lobes that are to do with self-control. And we know now from lots of studies that self-control is the single biggest predictor of success in life, way bigger than IQ. So the ability to delay gratification and exert your self-control is hugely important for your success. Mm-hmm. And it is like a muscle. It is use it or lose it. So as you're living that sedentary life, you're losing volume, particularly in your frontal lobes. Mm-hmm. And then when we're in this world where we are faced with all of these things that hijack these reward systems and we can't exert control, we're using our self-control less and less. And we actually then start to lose it. So we then have an even more diminished capacity to do stuff that is hard in the moment, but good for us in the future.
Mm. Yeah, I've heard you say this, and I've heard many people say this, that, you know, if the pharmaceutical industry could wrap up in a pill what physical movement does for you, it'd be the end of all drugs forever, basically.
Yeah, look, Salton and Peterson, two legendary exercise physiologists, about 5 years ago, released a paper giving strong evidence that exercise can prevent and or treat 26 of the most common chronic diseases.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Can you imagine if the pharmaceutical industry released a pill that could prevent and or treat 26 of the most common chronic diseases, right? So right now in Australia, 1 in 9 people, or 1 in 8 are on an antidepressant, mm-hmm. and 1 in 6 women are on an antidepressant. And we now know that it has a small effect size on depression. It's not much better than placebo, yet it is a multi-billion dollar industry on something that's really not that successful. Can also imagine if exercise was a pill, just how much that thing would actually sell.
I remember as the whole fasting movement got kicked off, the same argument was being made. It's like, you know, you could just do some water fasting and reverse your cancer or reverse your diabetes or reverse all of these different things. And everyone was like, it's free. You can do it today. You know, obviously people need the right guidance about the food around it and how to do it and all that kind of stuff. But that idea that you mean you don't have to put anything in, I don't need to put anything in and things will improve.
It is amazing what happens when you start to treat your body the way that it has been treated over hundreds of thousands of years of our species.
Yeah.
Which is lots of movement, eating good food, having good sleep, going to bed when the sun goes down, having really good, strong social connections, and having a sense of purpose and being connected into a tribe. And having intermittent fasting, whether it's deliberate or that's just because you can't get some food. But it is amazing what happens when you start to adapt that lifestyle, how your body will just react beautifully to it.
Oh, I'm 100% on board. That's basically the mission of this podcast. All of the things we're talking about is to get people more aware of just that this is at our fingertips. Like most of the work can be done so easily with just the basic supermarket. You don't even have to go organic or biodynamic or regenerative or, you know, go to a sauna. You know, they're all great little add-ons and ways to really enhance it. But, you know, I think about it like supplements, you know, it's like the bulk of the work is the actual food you put in and the sleep you get and the heavy things you pick up. And, you know, there's a lot of ways to do that as well around the house for free. But
yeah,
the saunas and the cold baths and all that kind of stuff are amazing. But if you want to start today, you can start today. Like, for no extra cost.
Yeah, absolutely. All of that stuff you talked about, that's the icing on the cake.
Yeah. Right?
And there are people, and I always talk about this, right? There are people who are spending a shitload of money on so-called longevity molecules like MNN and NR, touted by wankers like Professor David Sinclair, who is a Harvard professor. He's an Australian guy who's been over podcasts, who basically sold his research on resveratrol for $720 million to GlaxoSmithKline. And they shit canned it after a couple of years because they couldn't replicate his research.
Yeah, right? Wow.
And he's running a similar playbook around NMN.
Hasn't that been taken off the market?
So do you know why the FDA have taken it off as a supplement? Because David Sinclair created a company and then lobbied them to say that it should be a medical supplement.
Yeah, right.
So he is behind that being taken off the market because he wants to maximize it.
Well, when you've made a sale to a pharmaceutical company for $720 million, you've got a few dollars to do some lobbying, hey?
That's right. Exactly. And GlaxoSmithKline actually closed down the company that they bought off him for a few years because they could not replicate his research. He has now been outed by fellow professors at Harvard as a snake oil salesman. But he's all over these podcasts, right? He's on the Joe Rogan podcast. He's on all these other podcasts. He's been talking about resveratrol, metformin. He's talking about NMN and NR as these longevity molecules. You know, he's written a book that's been a bestseller. He's got a podcast and he's a snake oil salesman.
Irrelevant of this conversation, I've always just not really clicked with his messages. And every time I've seen him, I'm like, oh, it sounds woo-woo, but I'm just like, oh, my intuition's just not picking up on this.
Hey, mate, from the first time I saw him, my spider senses started to tingle.
Yeah, same.
And he was on, I can't remember what podcast he was on, but he was talking about metformin and how he doesn't need to exercise and nobody needs to exercise because they can take metformin. That was based on a single study that came out that showed that diabetics who took metformin actually lived longer than non-diabetics who weren't on metformin. And then other studies came out that actually that's not the case and that metformin can interfere with exercise. And then the next month he's on, I think it was the Joe Rogan podcast, talking about how he lifts weights and exercises and stuff. And I'm looking at him going, you've never lifted a weight in your life, mate.
Yeah, it's a bizarre world, the world of science. Well, it's one of the reasons that motivated me to leave is that I was sitting in rooms in conversations with PhD students and postdocs and, you know, and just I was so unconvinced by the scientific method in its corporate setting. And I think that's the important part is in its corporate setting. And sure, that opens up a conversation around, well, does anybody ever try and fund anything that they don't have an interest in? Maybe not. And that makes it really complicated because, you know, whether they're scientists or whether they're businessmen or whether they're both, that fund things that they want to profit from, you know, and we're all beneficiaries of this capitalist world. So it's a bit of a gray space or a vague area to kind of tease apart.
Look, it is. The corporate interests, it's a difficult thing to tease apart from. Now, there are lots of other funding bodies like the National Institutes of Health and stuff like that that do that.
Yes.
And still there are, you know, some scientists are quite a few who are still independent despite their connections with certain industries, but there are a lot of them who have just been caught up in that whole world of grant getting, and then they're on these boards that they don't declare. And there are a lot of vested interests that sometimes are very hard to uncover. And that is the problem, is sorting out the good stuff from the bad stuff.
It reminds me of Dr. Jason Fung, the guy from Canada that's all about intermittent fasting and time-restricted eating. Every time I've seen him do a presentation, you know, he gets a little kick from the audience out of going to the second slide. And he said, so now I want to talk to you about my conflicts. And then he goes, oh, there are none. Anyway.
I like it.
It's so good. He's like, I get funding from nobody.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
It's great. But I wanted to circle back to that conversation or the concept or idea with the younger teenage girls that are having the increase in suicidal ideation and actual suicide.
And self-harm.
And the thing that I want to ask, and I've been thinking about this for ages, and the sort of the before and after technology part of this question, which is, were we always, you know, really resilient because we just had the ability, we were surrounded by role models that we were able to copy and embody? Or is it that we have so much information coming into the human brain now that the human brain is opening, instead of opening 5 tabs for the day, we're now unconsciously opening thousands for every individual social media post we see, every bit of advertising we see? You know, we've got so many things to do in this sort of modern world that the overwhelm of both the conscious and unconscious mind is just unable to handle this many open tabs all at once. And so we're distributing our dopamine and our serotonin over thousands of ideas and therefore not fulfilling any of them versus simply deleting our social media, going back to having 4 or 5 things to do that day. You know, so it's like this idea that the illusion of choice is the thing that's causing the overwhelm of depression and sadness and anxiety because there's so much algebra going on in our heads of like, do this, do this, do this. No, this is better. No, this is slightly better for this reason. And we're just overwhelmed by this thinking that comes into play.
Yeah, I think the overwhelm has got a fair chunk to do with it. It's shown that if you give people too much choice, they actually start to get stressed out. But I think particularly for teenage girls, it's largely driven by social media. And Jean Twenge, who's a psychologist who's written about this extensively, has shown the very, very strong correlation between social media being available on the iPhone and massive increased risks of self-harm and suicidal ideation and depression, especially in teenage girls. And you don't see the same increase in boys, right? So there's a definite separation between boys and girls. And they believe a lot of it is to do with girls being on these social media sites where they're seeing other girls who are ridiculously beautiful and have all sorts of fillers and stuff in them. And the teenage brain runs comparisons, right?
Yeah.
That's the thing that it does, is it compares yourself to other people. And when, you know, way back in the day, you lived in a tribe, maximum of 100 people in a tribe. And if you're a teenager, there's a few others to compare yourself to. Like even back when I was at school, you know, you go to the school and there'd maybe be 100 kids in your year, or a few hundred kids that you would maybe see around the place. Yeah. And so you're doing those sort of comparisons now. And now they're comparing themselves to thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And they're seeing the best little airbrushed snapshots filtered of their lives, and they're comparing themselves to that, right? So I think particularly for teenage girls, the big thing is the social comparison that's driven by social media, because they're much more prone to it than teenage boys are. And you don't see the same increased risk with social media use of teenage boys as you do with teenage girls. And it's also a fact that teenage girls also that's when they massively drop out of sport and exercise. And boys tend to maintain it more on general, which I think it has two roles to play. Number one, they're exercising more, so their bodies and brains are better because of that. But it's also the time that they're spending on the exercise, they're not on the social media.
So picture this, right? Unlocking your potential, conquering emotional eating, and gaining insights directly from a health and nutrition expert such as myself. That's what we do inside the Healthy Mums Collective Facebook group, which is currently free to join. If you've ever felt trapped by food challenges, struggled with maintaining a healthy lifestyle, or yearned for a community that understands the reasons why you've yo-yo dieted for years, then there's a new chapter waiting to be written. And this is your chance to start writing it by joining us all on Facebook Lives, on engaging posts that push you out of your comfort zone and into growth, and Q&A sessions with me. All of this works as a platform to begin changing your emotional eating problems for good. Oh, and also, as a special gift, you'll receive my transformative How to Turn Food into Self-Confidence ebook. And that's also for free. I get it. Skepticism might linger. You might think, Maddie, I've heard these ads and I'm not sure. Well, at least a quarter of the members inside the Healthy Mums Collective Facebook group have been paying clients of my emotional eating program at some point over the last 3 or 4 years. So if you're not sure, you can post in the group and ask to find out if I'm the real deal or not. It's totally up to you. To join us in the free Healthy Mums Collective and to end your emotional eating and feel good in your own skin and begin that journey, pop down to the show notes below, click the link and breeze through 3 simple entry questions. Join today and let's embark on a journey of growth and empowerment. The link is in the show notes below. I'm wondering what's popping up in my thoughts with the difference in the boys and the girls. Has that got anything to do with like hierarchical psychology and the way that girls and women compare themselves and climb their hierarchy versus men? And what I mean by that is, you know, if we go back to tribe days and sort of we're talking about evolutionary biology, what I mean in this conversation is, you know, there's sort of sexual fertility and attractiveness and women are comparing each other, whereas men are usually results and resources.
Yeah. Look, I think that that certainly has a thing to do with it. And that's what the social media comparison, particularly the physical stuff, really plays into with girls. And I think with boys doing more sport, you know, they are satisfying that driver of being physically able. And, you know, so I'm able to be a hunter and all of those sorts of things. So I think there's an evolutionary biology component to it. I would definitely say, I don't know if any research has been done on it, but the pub test, the sniff would say, yes, it's definitely a contribution.
The sniff test, I like it. Yeah, well, and I guess transitioning into adults with that same conversation and having all of these tabs open, when it comes to our sort of neurotransmitters and hormones, are we spending that valuable and finite resource each day on too many things and therefore everything becomes bland and mediocre and sort of we're deriving very little meaning from the things and interactions that we're having?
Yeah, I think there's again a combination of that overwhelm that's going on. In conjunction with, we now live in a world where there are numerous things that hijack our reward system, that give our brains a reward that it wasn't meant to deal with. And then normal stuff that's supposed to give you a reward does not cut the mustard, right? So if we take food, you will not find anything in nature that has significant amounts of salt, fat, and sugar laid in on it altogether. And very few that will have significant amounts of fat and sugar, other than things like nuts, right? There's not very much. But now, scientists, food scientists all around the world are finessing the bliss point of a particular food, which is a combination of any two of those three, fat, salt, and sugar, that when you get the combination right, absolutely hijacks your reward system. And your brain goes, holy shit, this is amazing. You need more of this, right? So then, I mean, we look at kids now who just eat fruit. It's not sweet enough for them because the baseline in the brain of what is actually sweet has been fundamentally changed with all of this ultra-processed food. And even the fruit that we eat now has been bred to be much sweeter than fruit that is available naturally in general. So we are changing the baseline of what is actually rewarding. And then you have all this social media stuff that is driven for dopamine hits, right? And you have, again, the best scientists working out how do we make this stuff addictive? Because it is the attention economy. You know, there are so many businesses out there and their business model is on grabbing your attention and holding your attention for as long as possible. And you have these brilliant scientists using technology to completely grab our attention and to suck us into the vortex and to just keep giving us those little rewards that keep us in, that then we look at all their stuff and just go, well, that's not that rewarding in comparison.
I'm curious, based on your experience working with people and the research, I work with a lot of people and we start to, you know, rewire habits, and we talk about the idea that, you know, our current habits are serving some kind of emotional need, whether that be dopamine or whether it be, you know, masking a pain or suffering or stress. And so we need to rebuild the habit that still serves, you know, that sort of emotional purpose, because sometimes people need to do some work on some of the stuff that they've experienced in their life.
Yeah.
But we need it to be something that's going to produce sort of a, still a dopamine outcome, like instead of the chocolate, you know, do 10 push-ups, you know, yeah, for instance. And so we're still producing a dopamine outcome, but we're transitioning that space where that need was, you know, maybe the chocolate or the wine or whatever. And we want to get to the other side and it's like, oh, I don't want it as much. And the pull of that food is less strong. But I'm curious, I also hear, Maddie, I tried that 10 times and nothing's as good as the wine.
Yeah.
So my question is about the kind of the reversal of that set point of dopamine satisfaction, or, you know, that need being met that's been met for so many years and in many cases decades by the sugar, by, you know, the TV show or the Netflix or the social media. You know, like, what does it require to reverse that set point of the dopamine hit in order for 10 push-ups to be enough?
The answer is quite complicated, and I don't think anybody knows the answer completely. But what we know, I think you get some pretty good evidence from looking at drug addiction. So when you take drugs, whether it is heroin or even morphine or cocaine or any of these drugs, they give the brain hits of, and it's particularly the most addictive ones are the ones that drive the dopaminergic system. So we know that the drugs that drive serotonin, and, you know, we were told for many years that they're highly addictive, things like LSD, mescaline, yeah, psilocybin, we know they're not addictive, right? They are not addictive drugs. It's the drugs that hit the dopaminergic system, such as tobacco, cocaine, heroin, these sorts of things. And also this speed at which they bind to the neurons is really key. So there's a combination of how quickly that results in a hit in your brain, mm-hmm, plus how much it spikes your dopamine. And so that we know that drug addicts who take those sorts of drugs, their brain set point is completely reset.
Yeah.
And there needs to be a long-term intervention that is based in neuroplasticity to enable that brain to then function without this stuff, right? So we're, mm-hmm, seeing similar things on a smaller scale. And in addition to this, the thing I think that makes it more complicated is that lots of us will do behaviors that are just not serving us well because they're just built in as these habitual things that we do. And our brain is all about shortcuts and heuristics, because if you had to make a decision on every bit of information that come into your brain, you just would not function. So we end up with a lot of habits that we still do that aren't serving us well, and we don't know why they're doing them because they're just automated behaviors.
Yeah.
And so number one, it's about realizing, people realizing the stuff that isn't serving them well. But then it's about breaking the habit loop in the brain, because a lot of these behaviors are automated, even if they're not giving us the same dopamine hit.
Yeah.
And then you put ones that are automated that are giving us a dopamine hit and maybe some other neurotransmitters, they become a shitload more complicated, right? And then when you have someone's brain who hasn't been exercising and is eating shit food and their self-control parts of the brain are withered away, it's a lot harder for them to, because we have to use self-control to overcome that. So, yeah, you know, it is a pretty complicated story. And I don't believe that I've given you everything that plays into that right there.
Of course, even
that is bloody complicated to try and untangle. Any intervention around changing behaviors, particularly behaviors that have become slightly addictive, has to be a multifaceted intervention that is based on driving neuroplasticity. So we need to support the brain. We need to give the brain the nutrients that it needs to function well. And another complicating factor is that when people are highly stressed, as a lot of people are, if they're overweight or not doing the things they want to do, when they're highly stressed, when you're stressed, what happens is the body robs the brain and nervous system of nutrients to create stress hormones because it prioritizes survival. So all of a sudden you have a central nervous system that is devoid of nutrients, that is not acting in the way that it should because it's not getting the right nutrients. So there has to be, for me, any intervention like that. And you look at some of the best drug rehab things, you know, people are in there, they're getting whole foods, they're getting really nourishing stuff. They're doing exercise stuff. Some of these guys are now starting to do breath work and ice baths, right? So they are. Yeah. And then they're getting cognitive behavior therapy on that. So for me, we need to feed the brain everything it needs in terms of the right nutrition, the right exercise, the right sleep, the recovery, and then work on the behaviors, the habits, the thinking things. We got to do it with the right foundation. Otherwise, it becomes really bloody hard.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you brought it up, like, because there's decision-making fatigue, but you brought up the prioritization of stress hormones and survival hormones. And we're also in a world where men have got totally cooked testosterone. And the saying is that men nowadays are a third of the man their grandfather was. And interestingly, when I got my testosterone tested, I was literally half of my dad's result.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm pretty healthy compared to the average person and mostly know what I'm doing. And so, you know, that sent me down a path. But then we've got, you know, especially for men and sort of to do full circle back to those construction workers, if we've got, yeah, people that are overweight, overstressed, underslept, eating terribly, their testosterone's cooked. And we know that men with higher testosterone are more driven, more focused, you know, more able to achieve goals and results. And so it's just so multifaceted. And that leads me to the question, do you think it needs to be one thing at a time, or like a drug rehab center where you're just thrown in the deep end and it's about, you know, treating yourself as an addict and being like, right, I'm changing everything all at once because I need this, you know, massive change in my life? Or can you be like, this year's focus is exercise?
Yeah. Look, for me, if you want to be successful, it has to be multifaceted. Mm-hmm. However, that is much harder to do. Mm-hmm. Right? It is much easier to get people to change one thing at a time than just go, hey, Maddie, tomorrow, brand new day. Tomorrow, we are going to completely change your diet. We are going to completely change your sleep hygiene. We're going to completely change your exercise. We're going to completely change your thinking patterns. And we're just going to start from tomorrow. Go. That's pretty hard. It works in rehab because people are in there and they've got no other choice.
I was going to say, it might be a bit easier if you come over and move in.
That's it. Exactly. That's right. Well, case in point. So my mother, a number of years ago, she had had diabetes for a number of years. She was very overweight. She was over 100 kilos. She's not a tall lady. She was on blood pressure medication for many, many years. I had been in cahoots with my dad. She arrived and I said, welcome to Camp Taylor. And so I sat down and had a chat with her, and then she was a willing participant in Camp Taylor, but we completely changed her diet. We started on a foundation of diet because I realized we needed to fix her metabolically before we added in any exercise. Yeah. She left 3 months later, 20 kilos lighter, and off her diabetes medication. Incredible. For the first time in 30 odd years, right? And had to reduce her blood pressure medication because all of a sudden when you fix metabolism, she didn't need the blood pressure medication.
Yeah.
So we need to have a number of these camps around the world that we can put people into for 3 months, right?
And sign
then everything
up.
Would be good. Because then what we know is the single biggest predictor of long-term behavior change is self-efficacy, the belief that what I'm doing is making a difference.
Yeah.
So in order to sustain that behavior change, people need to see the wins. Mm. And this is why a lot of these things don't work, because people don't see the wins quickly enough. And they go, oh, fucking hell, this is just too hard. Right? I'm just going to revert back to type.
Mm. That makes me think of the idea of striving towards a goal rather than striving towards a transformation in identity. You know, I'm doing this because I have to versus I'm someone that does this.
Yes, that becomes really interesting, right? So psychologists used to think what we'd seen is that exercise is a gateway behavior, in that all these big studies showed that if people who weren't exercising, if they could maintain an exercise program for 3 to 6 months, then all of a sudden they would willingly, of their own volition, start to adopt other healthy behaviors, such as changing their diet or stopping smoking or reducing their alcohol consumption or drugs or whatever it may be. And for many years, psychologists, we think it's to do with an identity shift, right? So let's say Maddie was 120 kilos, drunk and smoked like a gladiator.
And in another life.
Yes, indeed. And then all of a sudden, and Maddie, the construction worker, has this idea in his head, identity, that I'm hard drinking, I'm hard smoking, you know, I don't exercise, but, you know, I'm comfortable with it and I'm the life of the party. And then all of a sudden, Maddie starts to exercise for 3 to 6 months. Psychologists would say, now he has two different identities going on in his head. Yes, he has that old identity, but he now has Maddie, the fit person who is exercising regularly. So he has this fundamental identity clash in his brain, and he needs to resolve this clash in one of two ways. He needs to get rid of one of those two identities. So he either stops exercising and reverts back to type, or slowly he starts to change the other identities to fit in with the new identity. Mm-hmm. And so there was a, you know, reasonable amount of, I guess, good theory behind that. And then the neuroscientists came along, having put people in MRI machines, and went, actually, Maddie's just grown a heap of volume in his frontal lobes, particularly his right frontal lobes, which is the seat of willpower and self-control. So he actually now just has more self-control to be able to reduce his drinking or smoking. And maybe it's a combination of those two things, right? Mm-hmm. For me, I like to get people to focus on the process rather than the outcome. So yes, set your goals. And there's a whole heap of stuff we can do around goal achievement and behavior change. And, you know, firstly, identifying why it's important to you at an emotional level and linking your goals to deeply held values, and then reminding yourself every day. But then it's about the process. Okay, so what do I need to do to achieve those goals, right? And I, when I'm working with people, if that goal is more than 3 months away, I say, write that down, forget about it. Now let's create a 3-month goal. Now let's create a 1-month goal that is a waypoint to get you to your 3-month goal.
Yeah.
Now let's create weekly waypoints so that your brain will know every single week that this is working, right? And now we need a process. And in the process, you write that down. I use a thing called a ritual board. And you can see a kind of a ritual board right here where I've got the things written down and I tick them off as I do them. So having that board, number one, is a visual trigger for me to do the behavior. Mm-hmm. But secondly, when I tick it off, it's a little hit of dopamine because the natural rewards for the brain, food, water, sex, nurturing, and achievement. Mm-hmm. And so when you achieve stuff and you're ticking it off, your brain goes, that shit felt good. Let's do it again, right? And so
I got
then,
mine right here.
There you go. Boom. Then by continuing the process, you build self-efficacy, and then you start to hit those waypoints, whether it's a weight loss waypoint or a fitness waypoint or whatever. And that then builds your self-efficacy in your brain saying, this is worth it. All of this sacrifice is worth it because I can see my goal getting closer. And we know that when your brain knows that you're in forward motions towards a goal, that's when it releases dopamine. So dopamine is about anticipation and goal-directed behavior.
I'm curious. So you said before that when the neuroscientists came along, like the psychologist sort of said there'd be two identities and the person would need to pick one. And then the neuroscientists came along and found that there'd be a part of the brain that had grown, you know, many more neurons and now they've got more self-control. Does that mean from a neuroscientist standpoint, self-sabotage is just a lack of those?
I haven't looked into the neuroscience of self-sabotage, but I would certainly think that maybe is contributing, but there's probably more complex mechanisms at play, you know, and we got to look back at people's beliefs, you know, deeply held beliefs and things like that. You know, why are you sabotaging yourself? I'm not saying that there's only room for either psychologists or neuroscientists. I think there's room for all of them, and the nutritionists and the exercise physiologists and the breathwork people and all of those people. Because it's basically, it's about how do you get your metabolism right, right? In both your body and your brain. That's the key thing. And that requires a multifaceted approach.
Yeah, I totally agree. So you have a book, Death by Comfort.
Mm-hmm.
Where can people get it? Why should they get it? Give us the pitch.
So my book, you know why I wrote it? Because I was just sick of people when I was doing corporate talks going, have you got a book? You need to write a book. You need to write a book. So I just got hassled.
I get that question all the time as well.
Yeah. So I just got hassled into writing a book. So I thought, right, I'm going to write a book. And then I come up with the title Death by Comfort, which my publisher loved. And I actually like that. So it's basically why modern life is killing us and what we need to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
So in that book, I go through all of the what our genome is actually designed for, the stuff that we talked about earlier on, and how modern life is basically trashing our genome, or certainly our gene expression, and how that is creating a whole host of physical and mental chronic diseases. And then, more importantly, it's what we can do about it. So I got a chapter on nutrition, I got a chapter on exercise, I got a chapter on sleep hygiene, one's on recovery, one's on the benefits of heat and cold exposure. And also, really importantly, I've got a big chapter on behavior change because knowledge is one thing, but we need to actually apply that knowledge consistently in order to create shifts.
Absolutely. And where can people find that? All the bookstores, Amazon?
Yeah, it's on all the bookstores, Amazon. If you're in Australia, Booktopia. Or actually, if you're in Australia, the best place is on my website, paultaylor.biz, because you can get it for the same price and I'll send off a signed copy.
Oh,
that would be the best place to go and get it. But if you're outside of Australia, just jumping on Amazon is probably the best place to go and get the book.
Too easy. And is there anywhere else, social media or anything that you want to point people in, or just your website's the main one?
Yeah, well, there's the website, but what I'll do is I'll give you my link tree.
Okay.
Which you can put in the show notes.
Yep.
So that'll have a link to a hidden page on my website.
Sure.
Where people can go in and there's a whole heap of extra assets and videos and downloads and stuff like that that they can do on it. It'll also link them to my Instagram account as well, my LinkedIn account, and my freshly minted TikTok account.
Oh, watch out. He's going live on TikTok.
Indeed, yes. There's only a couple of posts on there at the minute, so I need to get my finger out.
Yeah, sweet. So I guess before we wrap up, what is one piece of health information that you wish more people knew about?
Can I give you two?
You can give me two. You can give me three if you really like.
I'll give you two. The first one is that no one is coming. No one's coming to sort your shit out. They're not coming to get you in shape physically or mentally, to fix your relationships, to make you a role model for your kids, or to help you achieve your life's goals. They're just not coming. It's all about you and the choices that you make every single day. And the second one plays into that. It's that all this stuff that we talked about is not easy. None of this stuff is easy. I'm not suggesting that it's easy to change your diet. I'm not suggesting it's easy to exercise, to get into a cold shower or an ice bath, or to consistently try to change the way that you think. It is hard. It is hard. Mm-hmm. But I tell you what's a shitload harder is living the last 10 to 15 years of your life riddled with chronic disease and not able to do the stuff that you want to do. And when you talk to people on their deathbed, their biggest regrets are not achieving their potential. And that's a shitload harder. So choose your heart. Because by not doing anything, you're choosing a path. And you're actually choosing the harder path in the long run. There are no easy choices. Choose your heart.
Mic drop. I don't even want to say anything. Some powerful take-home messages, but Paul, thanks so much for being here. I reckon we could do 10 of these podcasts, and maybe we should, but thanks for being here, and I hope to catch you on the next one.
Yeah, absolute pleasure, Matty. Anytime, and I'll get you onto mine as well.
Awesome. Thanks, mate. See you later.
Cheers.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learned anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast. Simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.